Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. February 16th, 2015, episode number 73. Here we go again. Here we go again. For today's notion, it has several meanings for which I will explain. I spent this afternoon in the garage. It was 9 degrees on the thermometer, fixing my snowblower. It, like me, is getting old and not working as well as it used to. Fortunately for it, there's a matter of changing the auger belt, and lo and behold, it will be as good as new. I'm fixing the belt because the forecast is for more snow tonight. It seems like every week, once or twice a week this winter, we've received a couple inches here, a couple inches there, and a couple weeks back we got a reasonable snowfall. Now, New Jersey is in the Mid-Atlantic region, and we have nothing to complain about when compared to Boston, which has received, to my knowledge, over 7 feet of snow, and another storm is heading their way as we speak. So for those people up there in that general vicinity, I feel for you. I can only imagine how terrible your winter has been. Like the sentiment of our last episode, I can only imagine you folks are waiting for spring in earnest. So here we go again has another connotation for me. I've been sick over the last couple of weeks, and I don't want to belabor the point here, but I think if I went back and listened to previous episodes, you could probably count that the last couple of winters I've had this difficulty, and it's really been frustrating, but I don't want to talk about that anymore. Let's talk about what we're actually going to do here. And by the way, hi, I'm Kevin England. I'm your host. On this episode, Discover Life website, talk about what that is and what a great resource it is. Living Life Foundationless, a segment on how to get started foundationless. Talk about HiveTool.org, the making of short mead in the house. A company called Paramount buys a beekeeping company that's in the news. The Flow Hive is all the rage right now. And a smidge of an editorial on the miticide conundrum. And then we'll finish off with some closing comments. Like any other episode, I suppose we'll have a short local hive report this time around. Let's go ahead and talk about what we have going on in our bee yard. Locally, it's been extremely cold over the last couple of weeks. I've been out to the hives when I went out to collect some firewood not too long ago and took a look, and wow, they're really, really light, and I don't have good feelings about them. I know I've lost one hive already. I'm pretty confident I've lost another. There were 9 hives on the property going into fall, and who knows where we're going to be in the spring. When I got up this morning, it was -0.2. on the scale, and it's been extremely cold. I think it's 12 degrees right now, and we're expecting another 3 to 5 inches of snow, I'm hearing, for the morning. And as you just heard, we're geared up for that. Maybe I'll have a delayed opening for work where I get to have the pleasure of plowing out the driveway. I've been focusing my energies internally, meaning working in the garage and in my basement workshop on getting some equipment ready. I built this neat hive jig, and I've been building some boxes and found some extra plywood and boards to work with, and probably by springtime I'll be building out a number of hive traps. Recently someone mentioned to me that there's a possibility of some feral swarms in a bee tree somewhere not too far from us, and they were going to be kind enough to ask if they can get some permission for me to put some bait hives up there. And I was just talking to Bob Kloss while we drove down to the state meeting on Saturday about potentially walking some wooded areas not too far from us to look to see if we could find some resources. So my focus in the springtime is looking to see where we can possibly harvest out some feral hives here in New Jersey and do whatever I can with the hives that I have remaining coming out of winter. That's it for the local hive report. There's really not much to it. I will say a special thanks to John Gott The person from our past interview in the most recent episode, he came down actually to the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association meeting and presented what he presented here on the podcast in person for us, and did a really good job. It was well received, and we appreciate him taking the time to come on down from Mahwah, New Jersey to talk to us about that. I'm interested in possibly looking at insulating my hives next year, and I'm really looking forward to a warmer day. They've been saying that the end of February has a day coming up where it'll be 50 degrees, and I'm looking forward to getting out and seeing which hives are flying. And I've made some fondant recently. I wanted to try a recipe, so I have some feed available, and if I find my hives are light, I'm going to crack them open and put some stuff in. Bob and I were having a conversation down to the meeting again about whether or not, even though it's cold, if these hives are starving or really light, should we crack them open now? I'm in a let them be kind of mode, which is just let them be. If they're not there, I'm not going to open them. They're going to get what they get. And, I don't know. I wax and I wane on this every day. But for right now, I have left them be, and we'll see what happens when we get to a warmer day. It would be really difficult to get to the end of February and see your hives starve at this time. And quite frankly, the last couple of days have been the hive killer days, where it's been really cold and extremely windy here in New Jersey. And hopefully our hives, all of our hives collectively here in the state and around us, are hunkered down and doing well with this. And we're looking forward to a really nice spring. So that's it for the Local Hive Report. Let's dive right into segment number one. Segment number one is called Discover Life. If you browse to discoverlife.org, you will find an amazing resource for identification of an abundance of what exists in nature. Plants, vertebrae, fungi, fungi, whatever you want to say there. And yes, insects are cataloged there in what is one of the most amazing resources I've ever seen. There are guides for bees, wasps, bumblebees, butterflies, caterpillars, cicada, crickets, katydids, dragonflies, and yeah, well, you get the picture, insects of all types. Unlike many sites which have the common items, this appears to have one of the deepest identification of bee species that I've ever seen. Now, the guide's a little old-fashioned. From an interface standpoint, it's what a card system is in a library to doing a lookup in Google or Bing these days. The technology runs in a really old-looking website, running in frames, and it's extremely crude by today's standards, but still, if you're concerned, it's really about the content. There's a guide there that provides a primer on how to do things. You can read that or just start clicking around to see what you come up with. In my case, I shot a video of one of my hives attacking a bee, but not a honeybee, and I wanted to know what it was, and that's what led me here. The site provides facets for you to select on. Facet. Let me explain that. If you are an age to go and purchase wine, then you probably chose it by a facet and didn't realize that's what you were doing. In the store, are you looking for a red wine or a white wine? That's a facet. France or California? That's a facet. $10 or $100? That's a facet. In my rudimentary but not entirely accurate use of the concept, it's kind of like how to choose what to select on. There was a car commercial not too long ago, or actually it was probably quite a while ago, where they say, I want a car, a new one, a red one, Cadillac. No, it was a convertible. And you see the car zooming around, and it comes down to that perfect car for that person. They're doing a facet-type search. And for insects, the facets vary. Is it a yellow-legged bee or a black leg? Hair on the abdomen or none? You don't know the details of the bee anatomy, then just choose the species by geography. In this case, I could have chosen the eastern half of the United States and even down to New Jersey. There's even an option to plot insects by a map. So, for example, I chose the species I was looking for and reviewed a map of New Jersey and what was reported there by who. So people who have seen certain insects, a lot like birders saying, I've seen this bird in my area, they've actually reported where they've seen these different types of bees. Did you know that right where I live, someone logged an eastern carpenter bee, a Cyclopia virginica? Did you know that's actually the insect my bees were protecting the colony from? How cool is that? I viewed a page with dozens of photos, identifying features and a full description of what that insect looked like in a very detailed biological description and more. And because I had taken a short video of the bee being attacked at the entrance to my hive, I was able to compare all the different aspects of the bee to the description that they had and make the match out of hundreds of bees to choose from. So one of the tips for you is if you're trying to identify an insect, go there, kind of learn about what the different aspects of the insect are, and then you'll be better suited in the future to identify it. It's not unlike plant identification where you look at the leaves and the surface of the leaf and the scallop of the leaf and the veins of the leaf. Insects have the same thing with the legs, the wings, the face, the antennae, and so on. So even if you have no inkling to find something, just visit the webpage and enjoy the tour of whatever you discover. And for those that have ADHD, www.discoverlife.org. I'm saying that to you now. I just gave you the URL. Please come back, because I know right now you're going to leave if you're sitting at a computer and go there and start clicking around, and we won't see you again. Segment 2 is coming next. We'll have a link for this on our show notes, and I might as well tell you what they are. You can go to our website, www.bkcorner.org, and should you have questions, comments, or just want to say hi and tell us how you're doing, it's kevin@bkcorner.org. Segment number 2, I call this one Living Life Foundationless. Recently, a soon-to-be beekeeper came to our association with the notion that he wanted to get started this spring and wished to go foundationless from the beginning. This person, whom I was meeting for the first time, displayed a passion for detail, and he had already done a considerable amount of research on the topic of beekeeping and the aspects of integrated pest management, foundationless strategies, and mite control. I admire his approach and looked to do him justice by providing a response worthy of his inquiry. So I sent him to Bob Kloss. That's a bit of a joke, but as they say, many a truth is spoken in jest. A Kevin moment, by the way. I always like that saying. It's apparently something attributed to Geoffrey Chaucer in 1837, or 1387. End of Kevin moment. I guess for the uninclined, it might be practical to take a moment to explain foundationless and its appeal. Foundationless is just that, a frame without a foundation base. It can be the whole frame, a whole frame with a starter strip, a partial frame, a top of a frame with two sides, or something akin to a top bar hive with just the bar. One common thread about foundationless is that the beekeeper provides some form of protrusion along the bottom edge of the frame for the bees to hang from. Or better said, for the bees to hang wax and comb from. Some people use popsicle sticks on their side. Some start with a starter foundation strip where they cut 1 inch down or 2 inch or whatever it is foundation. Or even a groove or a wooden guide shaped for the bees to get a head start with. Sometimes beekeepers wax that wooden guide to give the bees a place to affix their wax to, kind of like a cheater strip, or they leave it plain and there are people out there who say leave it plain, that and the bees will follow that guide, and what they affix to the wood will be stronger in grip than if you give them wax. Because typically when bees build wax and stuff like that, sometimes they mix a little propolis or resin in. They could build a stronger substrate than you can. And if they're attaching it to wood, they might do something special. Who knows? So foundationless, what are the advantages? It is said that just about every foundation sheet purchased from commercial manufacturers is tainted with chemicals. Former, and sometimes still in use, products such as Kumafos and Fluvalinate are said to be pervasive in the old wax, so pervasive that traces can still be found in new products today. If you're a commercial manufacturer of wax foundation, you're getting your wax sourced from somewhere, and you're not getting fresh, brand new wax from hives. It's just not practical to have that amount. So recycled wax is in the system for a lot of times, and much of it is tainted with chemicals. Another mite treatment that's used heavily in the commercial space is Ametraz, is also said to be showing up in the wax, among other things. Now, they purify this wax, but there's just no way to get some of this stuff out. Now, many would tell you that it's benign and not a cause for concern because they're only in trace amounts, but others take a more conservative viewpoint and look to avoid this altogether. Being foundationless means nobody's baggage. You start with fresh wax that your bees build, and in a perfect world, it doesn't get any better than that. So now back to the question at hand, how do you build a foundationless hive from scratch? I went the conventional route for the new beekeeper and told them to put foundation in. I suggested to let them build two boxes, and then in the second season start the strategy, which I'll talk about in a moment, to go foundationless. Why this advice? Maybe it's a cop-out, but it's hard enough these days trying to get a hive started and on the right track to survive 1 year. Try to start with foundationless and no mentor, and there's a probability that difficulties are coming your way. Bees don't read books, and if your first year hive is building wonky comb, cross combing between frames, and you have to dissect and rebuild, and you don't know what you're doing, and you've wasted your entire spring season, and now you put them back in sometime during the summer dearth, good luck with that. In my mind, telling them to do this is really a slippery slope, and it's a tough road for people who are looking to do this, even if you're an experienced beekeeper. And he was planning to do this on his own without a mentor and never have been in a hive box. I don't know what he was going to start with. I think he said he might start with some nukes that he was going to purchase. Anyway. So even a seasoned person might find this a task that requires a right touch and a little skill. So I'm not inclined to tell a new person to do this for fear of having them fail in their first year and go away altogether. In my mind, it's too risky. Now, this person was set in his ways. Good. Good for him. This is what I would tell him. I'd tell him to buy the Comb Guide Foundationless Top Bar from Walter B. Kelly Company, put sides on them, and put them in the hives and say a little prayer. If you want to find these, look for the F as in Frank style frame in the catalog. And incidentally, Kelly's instruction says you put a bead of wax down the bevel for the bees. So I said before, you could do that or you don't have to. Kelly is suggesting you will. So this is the conventional approach that I explained to him. And one that any beekeeper can get success at. In the spring, when you have the nectar flow, when it's coming any moment or it's full on, pull a brood frame out and replace it with one of these Kelly F frames. Bees do not like to have open space next to brood, and they will build out a frame quickly. You could do this also in a honey box, but let me explain the brood box thing. When they have brood, they need food right nearby. And when they have brood and the queen is laying in that area, she wants cells right nearby. So if you have a brood frame and an empty space with a guide and a brood frame, and you're in the middle of the flow, they will build that out pretty quickly. And the good news is, you're between two frames, so they'll maintain bee space. And you'll get a good foundationless frame. You could do this also in a honey box, but sometimes the bees build out the adjoining frames into the space where you wanted your foundationless wax, and they don't do what you wanted. If you're doing it with a honey box, use frames with established comb on either side of the open space and possibly capped honey, as they won't extend the face of the frame into open space if they have capped honey. At least that's my logic. Now, some of you out there are saying, Kevin, you're an idiot. People start top bar hives every day with no foundation, and you're just a fearmonger. Yes, I'm well aware of that. I have a top bar hive out in the yard. I've also heard one lament from people who are top bar aficionados that sometimes bees will cross comb and build wonky comb. They warn people of this when they're starting out in top beekeeping. It's one of the deterrents for starting with top bar beekeeping. If you listen to established people, they'll tell you, try Langstroth first and get your feet underneath you and then go top bar. I've come to learn that the person who made this inquiry is, in my words, a pseudo-citizen scientist based on his profession. I won't say what that is, his profession, due to anonymity. I just don't want to give away who he was or what it's about. But I believe that some people could pull this off. And if you're that kind of person, go for it. I'm giving information to a lot of people who are listening, and I'm going to kind of be the conservative, straight and narrow kind of advice giver. But I think this can be done. If you're really set on doing this, you can go ahead and try it. You have my blessing. I'm never of a mind to tell someone they can't, as long as they understand the risks, and I have thus shared them with you. So I also did a smart thing. I literally did refer them to consult with Bob Kloss, because Bob is the one person I know that has a lot of practical experience with foundationless frames, and he'll be in good hands after Bob chats with him. In some respects, this podcast is a little bit crowdsourced, and I'd love to hear your opinion. If you tried that right out of the gate, had success, or you know stories of failure, feel free to share them with me. I'd be happy to hear what other people's experiences are. If you have guidance on how to do this right away, I'd love to turn around and share that back out too. So kevin@bkcorner.org, you can write me a note. And if we get some feedback on that, we'll have a follow-up next episode. I will provide a link to the Kelly Beekeeping Foundationless Frames, the F-Style, F as in Frank, that I mentioned. It's a comb guide foundationless top bar. And if you go into their catalog and look at the style of frames, they have A through, I think, G. F is the one we're talking about. So I only had two segments prepared, but I have a number of pseudo-features in the roundtable section, and we might as well get to work here. Let's go ahead and switch to the back of the book, roundtable number one, hivetool.org. About every other episode, I seem to mention or get an inquiry on the citizen science of mentoring hives. It was interesting that Bee Informed Partnership spoke at our recent state meeting, and they were talking about the state of Maryland setting up hives that are going to have beekeeping monitoring kits that will be open to the public. You can go on the internet and see what the data is. And they were espousing a program where other states could get involved. And it is possible that you can potentially watch monitored hives around the world. That's something that seems to be gaining a lot of momentum these days with all the sensors, analytics, and other things that are going on in the Internet of Things space, which is the category where this falls into. So anyway, Bob Kloss sent over a link to the website that he found, which provides open source information on Hive monitoring capabilities. And I thought I'd share this as another resource for those of you who are interested in this arena. Linux, Windows, hardware, instructions, plans, user manuals, forums, all available from this website and another website, hivetool.net. So it's hivetool.org and hivetool.net. The sites go in depth with different facets. Kevin Moman, I like the way I worked that in after the description earlier. Kevin Moman end. The different facets of hive monitoring, acoustics, bee counters, weight, temperature, just about any type of sensor that you wanted to consider, it appears they have insights to get you going. One thing that I saw there that I wish I had found a long time ago was a scale resource. While not an incidental cost, so to speak, there is a scale, the Atom Equipment CPW plus 200 scale shown there. That's $160 and has an electronic readout and can run off batteries or an AC power supply. Like I said, there's a lot to see here if you're into this. One more bonus to throw in about this. If you don't want to get into the monitoring business but want to see some data on some hives being monitored, check out hivetool.net. That's what that URL is for. This is a related website. It has maps of hives with real-time data, and while most are centered in the area where this initiative appears to have been originated, North and South Carolina, there are a handful of others across the United States, and for us in New Jersey, there appears to be one in testing in Long Valley, New Jersey. You're starting to find more and more of this type of thing out on the internet. There's a website that I follow for weather called Weather Underground, and it just so happens somebody who lives about four houses up from me has a weather sensor in my area, and they're reporting weather conditions 24 hours a day. I thought that was rather interesting. We'll provide links to hivetool.net and hivetool.org in our show notes. Roundtable number two, making of mead. I recently posted a video at the Northwest YouTube channel about some mead that we made from a kit that my son Danny brought home last summer from a Renaissance fair. He was packing up to go away to school and found the kit and thought it would be a neat thing to do just before he left. The kit was from a company called Ambrosia Farm, and it featured a short mead with various spices that you mix in it. I have to say, it was an easy and enjoyable project and process to make the mead, but I still have a sense that I followed the instructions but have no sense if I did it right. I'm really not much on drinking alcohol, it's just not my thing, so when it comes to mead, I'm not clear that the outcome was what it was supposed to be. That being said, I did like the product, but in retrospect to the video, I have to wonder how far the fermentation really went. Let me explain. The instructions said let the mead ferment for 7 days and then start testing it for flavor and rack it off when it was the desired taste. I made the mead, but I didn't have a viable means of getting it out of the bottle when it was fermenting without pouring it, which is a no-no. You don't pour fermented mead because the spent yeast is on the bottom and it makes this must sulfur off taste. That just doesn't taste good, and you don't want that in your final product. In the case of moving it from one vessel to another, you siphon it. We made the mead when Danny was home, and the objective was for us to do it together before he left for his job in Seattle. And I ordered the supplies to siphon it off after we got finished, and it took 10 days before I could get back to it and moved it to other wine bottles. So it's not my notion here to describe the process to the point that you can follow how to make mead. If you want to do that, it was a step-by-step video that we produced. The siphon spot was not included in the video, and it was something else altogether. The siphon that I bought didn't fit into the bottle. That was the first problem. It was meant for a carboy, and the opening wasn't big enough. In the end, I extracted the center tube out of the self-siphon device, which wasn't really an idea. And on top of that, I bought food-grade tubing to use to hook to the siphon, and they only sent me a foot of it. The site sold it by the foot, but you could have fooled me because the photo next to the tube that I ordered was coiled and was long enough that it would have worked for what I want, and that's what I thought I bought. In the end, we improvised and we got the bottle siphoned off, and I put it in the refrigerator to stop the yeast from fermenting the alcohol or the sugars in there, which is what the instructions say. Now let me finally get to the point that I've been working to. We split what we siphoned off into two containers. One of the containers we left out on the counter, and the other one we put in the refrigerator to retard the fermentation. One thing that Sharon and I discussed is it didn't seem very alcohol-y to us. It had no alcohol pungency or bite to it. And lo and behold, the bottle that was left out started fermenting in earnest, and I suspect that even though the window for racking, by the way, that means moving it out of the fermenting vessel, vessel and into the destination vessels, was overdue according to the instructions. But this is what I'm thinking. The instructions probably think you're making this in the middle of summertime when 70, 80 degrees. I think what happens is the fermentation process doesn't happen as quickly when it's cool. It's a slower fermentation, which is supposed to develop better flavor. I know from previous mead experiences. But in the middle of the summertime, you don't want it to ferment so far that one, it becomes a very dry wine, and two, it starts getting funky flavors. Well, it's not summer, it's January and February. So my thoughts are that this thing has hardly fermented at all, and I'm contemplating taking what's in the refrigerator out, pouring it in the bottle with the other one that's sitting on the counter, and storing it downstairs and letting it ferment for a month and see what happens of it. I can tell you that even though the young mead is very fresh, it's very vibrant, it tastes good. It's almost like a hard cider or a spiced apple cider. It's got a very cinnamony, clovey kind of feel to it. And it's a little thick. It has a body to it. And it's really good. You could taste the honey underneath and a bunch of, starting to sound like a wine connoisseur, a bunch of different notes. It's very flavorful, but it didn't have that alcohol punch that I'm used to when I've tasted other people's meads. So one other thing about this process is I'll probably pull that bottle out, pour it in, and I did buy one of the, like a cork type thing that you put in a bottle, proper size, and I'm drawing a blank on what it's called. Can you tell I'm a little off today? That's just life, I guess. I'm still not 100% functional, but trying to get through. There's a device you buy that has water in it. It works like a trap. It lets fermented air come out, but it doesn't let oxygen go in and wreck what's in the bottle. I have one of those. I'm going to put it in this cork thing, and I'm going to put this thing downstairs and let it ferment for a month. And I'll test it every once in a while and see if it gets a little more alcohol notion to it, since it is a mead, and it's supposed to be. So this mead is a short mead. It's only supposed to be in your refrigerator for 4 to 6 weeks before you consume it. Unlike long meads, which have different processes, and you could ferment those sometimes up to a year or more before they fully develop their flavor. Okay, enough of that. I have a couple more things before I move on to talk about. Just some interesting back facts on this. The first thing is the instructions for the product were derived, according to the manufacturer, from a book dating back to the 1600s. I, being the curious type that I am, went to review the source and found the book on the internet. It is, as you would suspect, a book written in 1500s and a bit difficult to follow. My guess is that since it's so old, it's public domain, and that's why you can find it. in the one recipe that was cited on this as the source for the short mead that I made, I learned that in several other books and in this recipe, the instruction said, make your liquor to, quote, bear an egg, end quote. And I'm reading that and saying, what the heck do they mean by bear an egg? Because I was wondering if I could use the recipe to derive my own spice packet that goes in this thing and not have to buy the kit, no offense to the manufacturer. It's just a curiosity. So this is the explanation of that. The passage sounds like this in the book. When it is blood warm, put the honey to it, about one part to four parts of water. But because this doth not determine the proportions exactly, in parentheses, for some honey will make it stronger than others, end parentheses, you must do that by bearing up an egg. Egg spelled E-G-G-E. So I could follow all the instructions on that recipe from the 1600s, but that line didn't make sense. And it turns out, with some research, that in the 1600s there was a practice to check the sugar content of a product by placing an egg in it to determine if it floats or not. This so-called egg test works because a fresh egg will sink in water, but in a solution that is saturated with salt or sugar, it will begin to float once a certain gravity is obtained. Gravity in brewing terms is associated with sugar concentration, and it matters that there is enough sugar in the mix for the yeast to consume to make a beverage that is alcohol and not sugar water. So if you think about it, beer is generally 2 to 12% alcohol by volume. Wine is 9 to 16%. Most of those, however, fall in the 12 to 14% range. And mead is said to be 18 to 16% by volume. So in short, the more sugar you start with in your mead recipe, the more kick you get if you let it ferment. So if you take a fresh egg, you can use that as a primitive version of a hydrometer to get the concentration of the solution of sugar in the water. I thought it was an interesting aside and good enough to share that. I hope you enjoyed my little sidebar. And I have to say thanks to, and I'll spell this, florilegim.org website for the insights on the egg test. It really took me a while to find this, but it literally, in that website, referred back to Digby's 1600 reference to explain the egg test, the same book that the manufacturer of the mead used for the short mead recipe. So I'll provide a link to the show notes for their insights on it. And the other thing that I wanted to mention before I move on was the kit was purchased by Ambrosia Farms. I don't know them. I don't have any affiliation with them. But if you ever had the inkling to try mead at home, this really might be a good way to do it. It was my first mead adventure, and I'll admit that I didn't mind the figurative hand-holding via using a kit that had step-by-step instructions. Their website also had a really informative FAQ that I found interesting on the processes of making mead and what the difference between short and long meads are and things like that. And their kits are really, I think, inexpensive. $10 kit, and they had a wide range of products to choose from for different flavors to make mead out of. So check our notes for Stefan's Florigelium egg test link and Ambrosia Farms Heritage Brewing Foods and Handcrafts. Roundtable number 3, I refer to this one as In the News. I kind of wish I had a Kiwi Mana news ticker soundbite to open this one up. This just in, Paramount buys a Florida beekeeping company. I watched the news on beekeeping for interesting tidbits, and I found this one intriguing. A farming company from the San Joaquin Valley purchased one of the largest beekeeping businesses in the U.S. so that they could guarantee enough bees for almond pollination. To me, this is an interesting twist, and you have to consider if it's just a business deal or there's more to read into the dynamic of one of the larger beekeeping operations now being run exclusively for the use of one almond and pistachio grower. On the surface, that's what I have to follow from the newspaper article. I don't know what these people are really doing. And I don't want to allude that this is some sort of evil or problematic activity, but it seems to me on the surface that this dynamic could set off a chain of events that would alter the way things are done in the industry. I'm in New Jersey. I am nowhere near California, so I have no idea if my speculation is right. I have no domain knowledge of the business models, but it smells to me of news, and I wonder if we'll be reading more and more about this type of activity. I had heard recently two counterpoints. One was there were plenty of bees this year to do almonds, and I heard another saying that this was the first year that there were not enough bees to do almonds. So if you take those two notions and play them against each other, the fact that a almond and pistachio grower bought a beekeeper, you have to wonder if there's something to read into it. So we've been hearing in recent years about the cost of pollination and especially the impact of the almond growers. And it seems logical to me that it's something to keep an eye on. And quite frankly, every beekeeper in the U.S. is influenced in one way or another by the almond honeybee pollination dynamic. I also heard recently that several veteran beekeeping companies, and I don't want to be a fearmonger, again, I have no visibility, but beekeepers are like Chatty Cathy sometime. They do talk, and that some of them are just, they've had it, they're done. And if you do see some form of collapse, could it be that the almond industry is trying to protect their interests? Yeah. Cue the X-Files music. All right, I'll step away from this, but I can't resist in calling out one little tidbit before I go to the next roundtable. Maybe this is conspiracy on its own. The source of the story? The Fresno Bee newspaper. Roundtable number four, this one's called Flow Hive. Every once in a while, something strikes a nerve and a viral video or news story about beekeeping surfaces and gets passed among the beekeeper community. What it is about varies. Sometimes it's about a beekeeping practice, a hive design, the sun hive comes to mind, a promotion, and of course products for sale. Recently, a video about a new hive design that allows you to harvest honey from a protruding tube that you turn on like a spigot into jars has been making the rounds. Honeyflow.com is the website, and there you can watch a number of vignettes in a short video with people enjoying a trickle of honey into a jar and even onto pancakes for breakfast. One person says, "It's amazing, it's honey on tap," in the video. I love innovation, but there are times I'm dubious of things that are too good to be true. This looks amazing, and I wish to suspend disbelief. So I wait and be patient and dream about the science that was involved in the design. Immediately, my mind gets to thinking, how did they do it? I've watched the video a half dozen times and dream of how it is done and their ingenuity. I'm excited to see this, to know if this is a new revolutionary idea. And if true, the one aspect is very appealing, to fundamentally not have to open a box to get honey, not for ease of it, but more for the aspect that we are not going to interfere with the bees. That would be a cool advancement in beekeeping. I fear what I've just shared is judgmental in the way that I've delivered it. It seems to me that it is almost unavoidable to talk about this and not infer skepticism or even exuberant enthusiasm. So hear this from me. Support them. The inventors are Stewart and Cedar Anderson, and they are looking to start a Kickstarter campaign to fund what they are doing. Do your homework, and if it makes sense, build a buzz and give them the support they are looking for. It is, after all, a great world we live in. Their Kickstarter starts off on February 23rd. I'm assuming that's the date based on the info I saw. To follow along and to see the video I mentioned, visit honeyflow.com or you can like their page on Facebook. It is facebook.com/flowhive. You can also subscribe to their, it's a newsletter where they'll keep you posted on their progress. And thanks to the several listeners that sent this along. And again, we'll have a link in our show notes if you didn't catch that. So one more to share with you, roundtable number 5. This is called the Miticide Conundrum. You will learn that there are a ton of thoughts on this, the whole 10 beekeepers ask 10 questions, 100 different answers thing, or however that's stated. It's been repeated a billion times. Some would say that miticides are just not necessary and counterintuitive. For me, one will want hives to survive for monetary and spiritual reasons, as there's nothing worse than losing a hive. To protect your investment, common wisdom is to monitor mite loads and treat when thresholds are breached. Treatment or integrated pest management options are at the beekeeper discretion. Chemicals, breaking brood cycles, splits, and other options really are bee management practices, and you have to know how to apply them. The shorter answer is, this can get complicated, and this can and has been the subject of books. For example, Morse and Flotham have one out. For new beekeepers, I'll offer a different suggestion. And this is really aimed at new beekeepers because this is the time of the year that they surface and ask for advice and guidance on this. I won't steer you in one direction or another, but I will share what is common wisdom in our region, the Mid-Atlantic region, or at least what is known to me. Learn what your options are and use them on your own merit. Unfortunately, there isn't some magic place to learn, but there's one resource in my mind that stands above all others, and that's Randy Oliver's scientificbeekeeping.com. Read what Randy has to say on Apigard, Small Cell Foundation, Ametraz, formic acid, and the other myriad of options for miticides out there. Then, find articles that discuss using splits for mite control for a means of breaking the brood cycle. And you might even find that on Randy's site as well, but a good alternative is Michael Bush's website. I would guess that Michael has something like that, as he pretty much has just about everything out there on his site. For New Jerseyans, I'll be an advocate of our state apiarist. In his presentation just this past Saturday, he shared the state winter death loss totals for the winter of 2013 into 14, 1 year ago. Treatment death loss was 23% of colonies. Those are for people who took some sort of measure to treat their colonies for mites. No treatment death losses in the state of New Jersey for the survey that they conducted was 45%. 23 if you did some sort of treatment, 45 if you did nothing. The year before, it was 29 if you did something, 44 if nothing. The year before that, it was 29 and 48%. Going back year on year for 8 years where he has records, the proportions are the same. And in some respects, I think there was one of them that was like 16% death loss for treat and 50-something percent. Wait, you know what? I have the presentation. Why am I doing that? Let me look. From 2010 to 2011, that winter, it was 18% was treated, if you treated, and 65% lost their bees with no treatments. Where am I going with this? I know and want to believe there is a way for treatment-free in this world. Perhaps treatment-free, when administered in a proper way, will beat treatment death loss. But thus far, I've yet to find anyone in New Jersey who's consistently beating the odds. I don't know where you live if you're listening to this podcast. And my heartfelt recommendation to you is find local people and follow their guidance. For your area, your habitat, your environment, your bees all might be different. I don't want to get into an editorial about this, but I will point out that the featured speaker for this past meeting and the person speaking from the Bee Informed Partnership both shared thought that colonies are being infested late in the year by visiting colonies that are not treated and bringing back mite loads in late September, early October timeframes. Let me explain that in a different way. You've treated, you've managed your bees, you've done everything right. You treat in July and August. When the bees start to ramp down, you've knocked the mites down so that they don't decimate your hive while they're still going. And then in September timeframe, when other hives around you are declining, your bees fly out, go in, raid their stores, and bring the mite load in. And they are all impacted, and they do not overwinter. That's the dynamic that's going on. By description of the two speakers this past weekend, I'm not sure the episode, but I do know that I've spoken about this dynamic in the past a couple years ago when recounting a story from Master Beekeeper Lanny Simone, who talked about her hives getting into someone else's hives late in the season and bringing back a mite load. And if she had not been monitoring, she would not have caught this. So I'm as skeptical as anybody else with this when it comes to this kind of stuff, but there have to be truths in this. If I count the beekeepers within flight distance of my home, I know at least a half dozen exist, and it's probably more over a dozen beekeepers who have yards within flight distance of my bees. One beekeeper I know in my vicinity called me over, and they were perplexed about what was going on in their hives. They were loaded with varroa and died every winter. And I know for a fact that my bees can reach that yard. I don't know if this person is keeping bees anymore. Last I heard that they had given up. All right, so where did I go there? Listen, if you're a new beekeeper, find your own way. Similar to the notion earlier, I would suggest you follow a conventional wisdom for your area for the first couple of seasons, and then if you wish to diverge from the common path, at least you'll have a few years' experience under your belt, and you could make more informed decisions. Treatment-free beekeepers would probably light torches for the advice I'm providing here, and I will offer this. Put your torches away. Step away from the torches. For those who want to go a different way, if you feel this information is not to your liking, go look for a different advice. The treatment-free people out there, they're also providing good advice, support, and service to their way of thinking in their own communities. In my mind, I'm willing to say that treatment-free beekeepers are out there doing whatever they're supposed to be doing. I've heard treatment-free beekeepers who do splits, they do other manipulations, but they're not putting chemical in their hives. And I've heard people who do nothing but leave bee in the box. Whatever. You know, I don't get too crazy about this stuff. I'm not thrilled to death if my hives are flying into people's hives that are infested. But in my way of thinking in the world, there's more than one way. And I am not convinced that my way is right over another. And you could choose your own management decisions based on what you have going on, and I will choose my management decisions based on what I have going on in my yard and what I see in my hives. And that's the key. Don't follow somebody's wisdom because you heard it. Know what you're doing and make the decisions based on what's going on in your boxes. That's the ultimate advice. I always hate to end on a soapbox, but that's the end of what I've got. I'm not sure if periods of this recording are high, low, disjointed. Because I'm coughing all the time, I have to keep stopping the recording and then coming back in and picking up where I left off. But it is time to close down the episode. I'll share that I've been on hiatus for a few weeks because I had this cold and it has really set me back. The day I got sick with flu-like symptoms was the day after the last episode recorded 5 weeks ago, and I'm still not 100%. I was out of work for a week, and I'm still miserable and waiting for spring. Fever. Yeah. Oh, woe is me. You don't want to hear it. Seriously, though, I am sick of being sick. And I appreciate the words of wisdom that have come my way. Believe me, gallons of tea, jars of honey, propolis, salt water spray in my nostrils, mucinex, Tylenol, you name it. I've been doing whatever I can to try and get this thing behind me. One person at work said to me on Friday, "Will you get better or just die already?" So that sums up how I feel. My project manager at work said to me, "The reason I'm still sick is that I have not put Vicks Vapor Rub under the arches of my feet before I put my socks on to go to sleep in bed." I think I might try that tonight. Anyway, I've done some things recently and have a few more things to report on for the podcast. And I'll save them up for our next episode. So hopefully I can get out from under this and be back with a healthier outlook on life. It's time to say goodbye. And with that, I will say, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, and be well, everybody.